For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so last time we introduced this thought that in this broader discussion that Paul is having with these Corinthians about how grace transforms not only individual lives, but whole communities of people, he begins in chapter 5 to address some very sensitive personal areas. And areas that were a source of great confusion to the people of Corinth, living as they did in an environment culturally where the most basic assumptions about who am I as a person and who is God and what does it mean to have a body and how do I should I live my life, all those basic questions, you know, those are not questions that we often think consciously about, but we have ideas about them. And cultures, of course, have views on these things that are reinforced in various kinds of ways. And the gospel, the good news about Jesus Christ, is taking root in a culture whose assumptions in these areas are just very far removed from the biblical ones. And so Paul, in chapter 5 through 11, begins to deal with some of these very practical issues and problems that people face in the Christian community. So last time we were talking about Paul's discussion about sex and sexual morality in a general sense, and I want to recap a couple points from that last time because it bears on our discussion today. Today we talk about sex and marriage, and next week we talk about sex and unmarriage, sex and marriage, divorce, and remarriage. So we're going to kind of cover the gamut. There's not a single person whose life won't come into the lens of Paul's discussion. So let's take a look at where we were last time. Four questions about sex that come primarily out of 1 Corinthians 6, verses 12 to 20, where Paul says, if we're going to have a meaningful conversation about the issue of sex, we have to begin with the issue of identity. And his point is that the practices that we do, the things that are important to us as people, we have to look at and say, how essential are they and what role do they play really in who we are? Because how we answer that question is going to say the whole thing about what do I do in this area. So, for instance, the area of sexuality in relation to our identity is something of an obsession in our world today. How does your sexuality relate to who you are? Well, that gets to the core in our culture about what does it mean to be desired? What does it mean to be acceptable? What does it mean to be significant and to have a place? And we identify our sexuality really as a culture right at the heart of our identity. And for that reason, of course, people are very neurotic about how they're viewed from the sexual point of view. Are they desired? Do they look the way they should look to be attractive and so forth? And it's just, you know, a multi-billion dollar daily preoccupation with so many of us. We're putting a weight on our shoulders in terms of our identity in this area that the Bible does not place. And that's important because if we're going to talk about the place of sex in human experience and within the context of marriage, we have to understand first who we are. And Paul says, you're not defined by what you do, your sexual activity. He says, such were some of you, but you were washed, you were made right with God. You're a child of God. And that is where we begin to think about who we are. And that gives us then a basis for, am I acceptable? Of course, because the most important voice in the universe accepts me. Am I desirable? Well, yes, I am, because God himself manifested himself in human flesh and died in substitution in payment for my sins. He desires a relationship with me. I matter to him. And so we have these real key issues of identity kind of nailed down as believers in Jesus Christ. And so the sexual aspect of who we are fits in not as the controlling, driving force of my life, but as we'll see in just a little bit, as a means of communicating with other persons on this most intimate level. We asked this question about spirituality and sex, and that comes into sharper focus in our discussion tonight. What's the relationship between body and soul? Can we just do anything with our bodies under the belief that it has no bearing whatsoever on our spiritual life? And what the scriptures teach is that no, in fact, we're whole persons, that we are an integration of body and soul and spirit, and that what we do in every element of our life and how we express our spirit, our body, our soul, all of these things are going to have an effect on the whole of who we are. So sex is actually has deep spiritual implications. Third, that the moral question that Paul raises in this passage is sex in the realm of taste or ethics? Is sex a matter merely of personal preference? No different in kind than the choice of what car am I going to drive or what ice cream am I going to eat or something like that? Or is sex, because of its significance, solidly in the realm of ethical value, that it does matter? There are rights and wrongs that relate to sexual practice. And this, again, Paul is arguing that, of course, sex, because it matters, because it's so significant, is something that is of ethical significance, that it should be protected by ethical judgments. And then lastly, the relationship of sex to the community, and we ask this question, is sex purely a private matter? And here, just the obvious point in looking at society is that while the act of sex may be a private affair, the effect of sex is very public indeed, and it affects many lives, and not just the lives of the people who are involved, but it affects the lives of children, and it affects the lives of others that we touch. And that's why Paul was so concerned that the Christian community in Corinth not have the twisted and bizarre views towards sex that the rest of the culture does. So that's just a basic recap of where we were last time. And we're going to integrate some of these ideas into Paul's discussion of sex and marriage, because Paul himself does that. And so here we go, starting in verse 1. He says, "Now for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to have relations with a woman." Paul's letter involves several answers to questions apparently that they were asking. And so it's introduced by expressions like this, "now for the matters you wrote about." So in chapter 8, verse 1, chapter 8, verse 24, chapter 11, and chapter 12, Paul prefaces discussions about things that he wants to get into and talk about with them in terms of questions that they have already asked him. And so, as we might guess, the first thing on their mind was sex. And so they raised this question. This was the theory that was being thrown out around in the church of Corinth, namely that it is good for a man not to have relations with a woman. And this, it seems, is very much in response to or reaction against some of the excesses that were a part of this group. There's a confusion in the Corinthian church that is very significant. And the present distress, as he calls it in verse 26, has to do with sexuality. And it is distressing. We had people walking around basically saying the body and the mind are completely disconnected, so you can do with your body whatever you want. And we talked about those folks last week, the ones who were saying, hey, the food is for the stomach is for food. You know, if you have a bodily urge, you should satisfy it. That's the way it works. And then there were others who were saying, well, you know, actually, the body could be a great distraction from the life of the spirit. And so it's better that you don't indulge the desires of the flesh, because that might interfere then with your spiritual life. Your whole focus will be on this world and not on God. And that, of course, is an attitude that has manifested itself in a significant way in the history of the church, unfortunately, because it is so far removed from the biblical point of view. But it's creating this stir within the church. And you can imagine, here are hundreds of people in this Corinthian church. And the whole question of, you know, should we have sex with our spouse? Should I even stay married to my spouse? Would that be wrong? All this stuff is up in the air. And that's why Paul has to address the fact that in reaction to this debate that they were having, some were saying, well, okay, you tell me I can't have sex with my wife. That might interfere with her sexual life. So I'll go find myself a prostitute. And that's, of course, purely acceptable within the Greco-Roman framework. Some were advocating celibacy and faithfulness in marriage. And so that they're saying what's really important is just to have this platonic relationship. We're going to talk about that in just a second. Others were saying, look, you know, we ought to just ditch the whole idea of marriage altogether. And so, yeah, can you imagine being a part of a group this size where there's no consensus on this point? And how would we be getting along? There'd be divisions within the marriages. There would be disputes among friends. It would be a complete disaster. And so guess what? This group that Paul's talking to, a complete disaster. So here's how it goes. There are very complicated circumstances. And Paul is able to understand that there are absolutes in this area. There are rights and wrongs. There's God's way, and then there's not God's way in some things. But because of the complex nature of some of these decisions people were having to make, there is also a clarity from Paul's point of view that God hasn't spoken to every particular circumstance. And so it's very interesting, and I think that there's an authenticity about this letter, because Paul is able to say on the one side in verse 6, I say this to you, his advice, as concession, not as a command. What does that mean? It means that in the thing that he's going to be talking about, that he can't really say, this is the way you should do it. It must be this way, because he doesn't have any kind of background from what God has said to make that point. He says in verse 10, I give instructions, not I, but the Lord. Now he wants them to know that he's got something to say, and it's not just his opinion. God has spoken in this area. Then he says in verse 12, I say, not the Lord. He's able to say, you know, there's a limit to what God has said about the sexual relationship and in terms of some of the circumstances you guys are facing. And so it's, I'm not speaking on God's behalf. I'm not going to presume that. I'm going to give you my opinion, as he does again in verse 25. So the reason I'm putting this out there to you is that there's a lot of confusion in this area. There's some ambiguity in the area of sexuality. The particulars of what we're going to discuss this evening, the relationship of sex to marriage, however, does not fit so much in this category. Paul is very clear about what is appropriate and what is right. He says in verse 2, because of the instances of sexual immorality, because people are going out and getting it on the side or whatever, each man should have his own wife and each woman should have her own husband. And so he's establishing a principle here that it's God's design for marriage that includes a sexual relationship. And then because it includes a sexual relationship by design, he goes on and he says in verses 3 and 4, and this is going to occupy a significant portion of our conversation tonight, the husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. And in the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Now that is a very profound statement that Paul is making here, and we need to unpack it, especially in this historic context. We want to ask this question about sex and what does it mean in marriage. In Greco-Roman marriage, and this is the context, this is the situation that Paul is speaking to, marriage meant something, and sex within marriage meant something very different than it does in 21st century America. For most Greco-Romans, marriage was more or less a merger. It was a way of maintaining social status. You marry someone who's your social equal, or if you're really lucky, you marry, like I did, a little above yourself. Well, this has obvious economic benefits, but also you're able then, when you have children, to pass on your name, to pass on your social standing, and to pass on your economic potential. Very, very important to the Greco-Romans. Also, I think in many places in the world today, very important as well. We make decisions for marriage in many places in the world today, not because we have found the one and we are in love, but because it's an arrangement that works for our social standing. And so as a consequence, we make these kinds of decisions about marriage, and then sex within marriage, because of what marriage is, takes on a very particular kind of role. Namely, the Romans viewed sex as simply, really, erotic pleasure. Eros, erotic. That just means sexual love. And that is what sex is about, is pleasure. And in their writing, in their poetry, in their thinking, there's a total disconnect, by definition, between pleasure and duty. Now, I have duties as a married person. And I have duties to my wife. My wife has duties to me. In the Greco-Roman world, there is a kind of contract that binds you together in marriage. And to the Romans, and really to the Greeks before them, the idea that you have responsibilities in marriage is what makes marriage possible. It is a contractual thing. But once you start talking about duties, obligations in the context of marriage, then it's impossible in their thinking to talk about pleasure. Because pleasure ought to be the kind of thing that is no strings attached. That you do because you want to, not because you have to or because you should. You see what I'm saying? This was the consensus. This was the outlook in the day and certainly in the minds of the people that Paul is writing to. Their whole outlook on what sex is has been more or less shaped in this way. And for this reason, of course, if you are a person of means, let me put it a different way. If you're a man of means, then you would probably find yourself a mistress that you can satisfy your sexual desires with while you go home to your wife who you're building this kind of corporate identity with. Now, most folks didn't have that kind of economic latitude, and so they would just do what most people did, which is they went down to the local temple and they had a sexual relationship with the prostitutes that were down there, and that's how it worked, and Corinth was well known for that. And so that is the kind of practice that's going on. That's the mentality that's going on as Paul writes to these Corinthians. And in that context then begins to paint this radical message of the relationship between sex and marriage. Radical to Paul's audience, radical I think also to us, and I want us to think together about what Paul has said here, because it is just amazing in terms of what it's being said and in terms of the implications for our own lives. Now, he has already said, he's laid down a definition in chapter 6, verse 16. What is marriage? And he says it is just exactly what Genesis chapter 2, verse 18 teaches, which is that in marriage, two become one flesh. That in the sexual union in marriage, two individual persons join together physically and as persons, and that is what marriage ultimately is for. And so as a consequence, the idea of sex in marriage changes. Just as it would, there are implications to the biblical view of marriage, two becoming one, just as there are implications to the Greco-Roman view of marriage, which is corporate merger. Okay, if the whole meaning of marriage is that two independent lives join together and become one life, then sex fits within that framework. And sex then becomes, and I've chosen this language carefully because I think it captures exactly what Paul's describing here, that sex within the context of marriage is serving our spouse as a whole person to a whole person. That is what sex is about in marriage. It is serving as a whole person, not just serving with what I can do functionally, not just serving for how I can be relationally and conversationally, not just serving in terms of my intellectual investment in my spouse, but also serving with my body to a person who is a whole person and who I am serving in the breadth of who they are as well. So sex in this sense, sex from the biblical view, is a practice that creates an intimate bond between people. And when we come together and we have a sexual union, there is a coming together emotionally. I think sex is an emotional experience, is it not? It is you coming together psychologically. You're coming together, your persons are connecting, and of course you're connecting physically, intimately, as you enter into the body of another person. And it is intended to create, to distill, to really continue to cultivate that deep breadth, that holistic unity that is God's design in the marriage relationship. But sex, and here I think is a very important part of this package here, sex is described biblically as a giving of yourself to the other. Now, giving yourself to the other in the context of sex has certain rewards. But it is an act of giving. And that is very important. In our culture, when we talk about sex, what do we talk about? We talk about giving sex? No, what do we say? Getting. You're getting. And of course, why? Because we have the Greco-Roman mindset. We think it's all about my pleasure. That's why I involve myself in sex. Well, of course, sex is pleasurable. There's no doubt about it. But at its heart, it is a giving of your body to another person. And with that comes an access to one another, a vulnerability to each other, an openness to each other that is not possible with any other kind of way of relating. It is the intimate bond of two persons becoming one that is the greatest human picture of what it means to be, in the image of God, namely two separate persons together in one essence. So there's something profound about eros. Erotic love is not divorced from agape love, the selfless love that is the love of God. And these work together because we're whole people. And as we seek intimate bonds with our spouse, and as we open our lives to each other and open our bodies to each other and practice that kind of total vulnerability with each other, then we are able to give. And as a person has made themselves wholly vulnerable to us, to serve them. That is the biblical view of sex within the framework of marriage. Now, sex communicates total acceptance. That's what we're saying. I accept you. I embrace you. Total commitment. all things are put to the side. It's you who is my focus. There is a delight that we're taking in our spouse. And these are the things that really help just distill that beautiful partnership that God intends in the framework of a marriage relationship. And so you can see then, if that is the case, why Paul would be pulling what hair he had left out when, because these Corinthians were just walking away from that beautiful thing. And they were saying, because I'm so spiritual, I'm just not into that, you know. And he's like, well, you just don't understand what this whole deal is about. And so there are implications. If that is what sex is for in the framework of marriage, there are implications for our spouses, for ourselves. And Paul signals two of them right here. He says the husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife and likewise the wife to her husband. Well, that's moral language, isn't it? He's saying, and this is completely out of character in terms of the culture, he's saying that men have an obligation to their wives in the sexual area and likewise the women to their husbands. There are sexual responsibilities. It's a choice that we make. And why are we making it? Because we are desiring to serve that other person and to distill in the deepest and most intimate way the partnership that God has brought together within our marriage. And so there are responsibilities sexually that we have for one another, with one another in the context of marriage. And then even more profoundly, he says in verse 4, the wife's body does not belong to her alone, but to her husband's. And because Paul understands that marriage is the union of two equals, he's not a misogynist, he's not a woman hater. He says the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. And so the body that we possess is not our own in marriage. We surrender when we enter into the marriage relationship autonomy. We surrender the rights to our own body. We make our bodies not merely available to, but we use our bodies to move toward our spouse as a responsibility, as a duty. We surrender our freedom. My body is yours, your body is mine. Okay. Now, this is very risky business, isn't it? And I think that if you look at the history of most cultures, you know, they understand part of this, namely the wife's body is mine, right? It's true. And most cultures are misogynistic in that sense. And Paul is saying something very profound here. He's saying that the husband does not have the rights to his own body as well. It's risky. Why? Why is it so risky to say what Paul is saying here? Paul is describing the sexual relationship as a very high risk, very high reward endeavor within the context of marriage. High risk, high reward. It's risky. Why? Because it is. If I've surrendered the autonomy of my body to another, then I can be used. I am entrusting myself to another fallen, distorted, self-interested human being. And no wonder, of course, in a culture that has no foundation for what we're describing here, that people would be profoundly committed to my rights and it's my body. Why? Because there is no basis for real trust within the relationship. I remember this when I was teaching ethics years ago in the university, and we would talk about ethical issues pertaining to the body, one of which was abortion. And we would talk as a class about, okay, what is a fetus and what is a newborn baby, and are they really different in a categorical way? Well, it seems like maybe not. And as a result, if it's wrong to take the life of an infant, then certainly it would be wrong to take the life of a highly developed fetus, at least as a minimum, at least in the discussion we were having. And people would follow that and just draw that conclusion. But then when it came to the inference, well, you ought not to take the life of an unborn child, the protest was universal. But it's my body. You see what I'm saying? It's my body. And I don't think within the assumptions of what a secular culture is that you will ever get beyond that discussion. It is only uniquely in the framework of a biblical view that we can talk about bodies not being the object of being used, of exploitation, but as something very beautiful indeed, and something to surrender to another. It's so risky. It's so risky if we don't have the foundation. And I understand that many of us even here come into our marriage relationships with having our intimate trust violated by another person, maybe as a child, maybe as an adult. Maybe we've been married before and it didn't work, and we're out of that relationship. And some of us, most of us, many of us are just very, very deeply broken right here at this place, right here. And our marriages, even in the present, are reverberating with the pain that we ourselves experience as God's design for our sexual lives has been violated, either by our own choosing or sometimes by the work of another. So it is risky business. It's very risky business that we're describing here. And the question that I want to ask you, and we're going to get some mics around, I want to have a little discussion about this, is what does it require to, as believers in Jesus Christ, to have a high-risk, high-reward relationship with our spouse and our spouse's bodies, a sexual relationship in that sense? Do you understand what I'm saying? How can we build the kind of trust that we need to be able to experience sex as God describes it? Who's got some thoughts about this? Really? How about Leah over here?
I have been married for 20 years, and I have a terrific marriage, but we both came into it with a very worldly view of sexuality. So even with a good marriage, but understanding that this part wasn't the way God would want it, what we had to do was pursue it and pursue it and pursue it. And eventually, I even got frustrated just trying to understand, how do you step out of what the world has taught you and try to understand what God is looking for on a day-to-day basis? And I frankly never did figure it out, except that this sounds so trite, letting God be there and letting him have it. And he comes through, and even after 17, 18 years of marriage, it makes an incredibly wonderful difference.
Okay, thank you. That's awesome. That just being able to come before God with your insecurities, with your fears, and allowing him to heal as we move toward a healthy physical relationship in our marriage. We don't know how that works out. It's not a formula, but we find that God is faithful. I think that's a very good point that you're making. Who else has a thought? How about Paco here in the front?
With Youth for Christ, they've got a workshop called How to Avoid Falling for a Jerk. It comes from a book. It's a great thing. And one of the the foundational illustrations is a chart with five columns. The first, and each column is ranked, you know, a 0 to 10. The first column is the word no. The second column is the word trust. Third column is the word rely. Fourth column is the word commit. And the fifth column is touch. And the premise is that as you go far along, you shouldn't be ranking of rightmost column any higher than the left one. You should never trust anyone more than you know them. You should never rely on them more than you trust them. You should never be committed to anyone more than they prove to be reliable. And you should never be physically intimate with someone more than you're committed to them. And the premise is, if everything else is up at 10, well then marriage is something to consider. And so when you ask the kids, well, you know, what's the world's view? How does it all go? And when they start marking numbers and it's all sorts of lopsided and you just look, well, it makes sense that that doesn't make sense. That mm-hmm. just, that looks wrong. Mm-hmm. But as people go through life, they don't quite see it in those ways.
Yeah, that's right. We'll come back to that next week when we talk about singleness. I think that fits in an important way there. The question, I guess, would come back to how do we cultivate this high risk, high reward thing within our marriages? We're married. How do we begin to move toward the experience of the things that God has for us there? What does it mean? What does it look like? How out in the back? I can't tell who that is. Yeah, well, all right.
I guess what comes to mind is that we're taking care of things throughout the day with our spouses, that we're building that trust just in little ways, how we treat each other, how we speak to each other, how we respect each other, how we serve each other. And I think that goes a really long way to building the kind of trust that enables the type of quality relationship you're talking about.
Okay, I think Carolyn's got a great point here, which is that we have to build within our relational framework an interest in serving that person at every level of who they are and not somehow just kind of swoop down in there for the sexual encounter and swoop back out. We'll talk about that a little later, too. Okay. Who else? Anybody else want to chime in? Okay, we'll get Matt in the back there. Go ahead.
Jim, is this on? Okay. I was just thinking about me on my wedding night, my first wedding night with my husband, have never had sex, have never walked into a situation in my life as a single woman, and as he also was a single guy and has never had sex either. And realizing how different it is than the world view and waiting for that moment with your loved one and building that trust. Mm-hmm. I guess that's where I got the trust from him, with him, and learning to trust him more in every way in our marriage.
Yep. Sweet. Awesome. Thanks. What you got, Matt?
I think, what does it require? I think honesty and communication.
Okay, good.
You know, I think there's such a tendency to be deceived, or for one person to be, you know, thinking one thing, and but to be serving in the way that you're talking there, it requires a lot of honesty, both, you know, positive and negative, when, you know, joys, things that you're really, you know, liking and not. Mm-hmm. And just the regular communication to work through those things together. Because it's very easy to drift apart if that's not there.
Cool. All right. Some practical thoughts here. Let's move on, because just in the interest of time, but I do want us to be able to think about this. We're talking about something that without a basis, if I don't have the capacity to actually put your needs and your interests above my own in the most intimate way, our marriages will fail. And maybe we'll stay together as a legal contract, but our marriage and the experience that God has for us is going to be so deeply diminished in terms of what God really wants for it. And this really speaks then to the idea that, what do I have to give in my marriage? And this is something where maybe you're here this evening, and one of the things that's brought you here is the fact that you have maybe been married for a while, and you're sensing that the walls are closing in on that marriage relationship, and you feel that sense of desperation, like, I don't know where this goes from here. And what we want to say in that way is that what you really are calling out for is God in your life. What you're really calling out for is the awareness that you don't have what it takes, and that is no surprise to God. Because to love in a selfless way requires that we have the core of our own needs met first as a base upon which we can meet the needs of the other. And so it is in coming alive spiritually to God through receiving Christ's sacrifice on behalf of our own guilt before God that we are able then to have resources beyond our own capacity to in a supernatural way, which is to say in a way that transcends the limitations of our own brokenness, to serve and reach beyond ourselves into the real interests, the real needs of that other person. And so I just want to call out to you, I guess, here is an opportunity to recognize that the what God has for your life and what we are able, apart from Him, to make of our lives, it just could not be different. That are just so radically different from each other. And that God wants you to have a deep and satisfying and fulfilling life and marriage. And He, as its author, is the only one who is able to bring us to that place where we can experience it. And He's offering to us, on the basis of His grace, on the basis of mercy, just to be reconciled to Him, to have Him take residence in our life, and to give us this capacity to transcend self for the sake of another. It's awesome. It's a beautiful thing. Well, moving on then briefly and just kind of drawing things to a close, he says in verse 5, he says, do not deprive each other, unless perhaps by mutual consent for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer, then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So Paul is saying basically in a theoretical sense, I suppose it might be argued that for a short period of time, and for the sake of your such busy prayer life that you have no other time available for your spouse because you are so deeply committed to prayer, that would be a temporary exception to what we're describing here. That's what he's saying. But the norm is do not deprive each other. And so let's just talk briefly about this as we kind of draw the net around our discussion. Sex is an interesting thing. Sex, a good sex life, is not a barometer of a healthy marriage. Let me say that again. An active sex life is not the barometer of a healthy marriage. Now, it's a part of a healthy marriage, but it's not a barometer of a healthy marriage. It's not a sufficient condition for a healthy marriage. But the absence of a healthy sexual life is very diagnostic. And that's something that we want to talk about here. That if we say, well, I'm not really interested in serving my spouse physically because, well, you know, what I'm really interested in is serving Christ. Paul's basically saying, nah. Not an excuse. Paul, the scripture, is not dualistic. He's not saying, serve God over here and at the expense of serving my spouse over here. That's not how it works. And I think this is very important. I know spouses, and I've had conversations with spouses who are having real difficulty in their marriage, and they're having difficulty over the question of one of the couple in their desire to follow Christ. And some people will find their spouse who is kind of resisting the thought of moving toward Christ in their life to be, a drag, and to feel distant from them for that reason, because they crave a sort of unity that's being deprived of them. And as a result, they keep the sexual relationship at a distance as well. And that works how? That works badly. Because it alienates, and it says, until you get your thing together with God, I'm not interested in you. When Peter says just the opposite, and he says, it is through the chaste and respectful behavior of the wife that the non-believing spouse is won oftentimes. And so we don't want to punish, and we don't want to use sex as a tool to manipulate, even for spiritual reasons. Sex and emotional closeness. This is an issue right here as well, and something that we might want to think about in terms of our sex life, because men and women are kind of different in this way. Some of us are extremely functional relators. I'm this way. I think my wife, to a large extent, is a functional relator as well. We're kind of functional people. We just function along. And as a result, it's easy to kind of minimize the emotional, the intimate dimensions of married life. A lot of us are like this, and that can be problematic. If we're preoccupied and distracted with lots of concerns, lots of things are vying for our attention, we've got weighty things on our plate, and as a result, we are not moving toward our spouse, and we're not building that close emotional connection and physical connection. It's a lack of a sexual life that might indicate, yes, I've got problems in this area. We may need to sit down and think about how are we relating to each other in the broader framework of our married life. And then, of course, there's just the difference between the way men and women think about sex. Did you realize that it's different? I hope you do. For men, sex is a catalyst for closeness. Right? Fellas, you want to feel close to your wife? What are you interested in? Okay? And then in experiencing the sexual relationship, you feel close to your wife. Right? Am I right? You're awfully quiet. Okay, come on. Come on. That is the way it is. Sex is a way to feel close if you're a guy. Ladies, I don't think you think of it in quite those terms mostly. Usually it's the other way around, that the interest in a sexual connection with your beau emerges out of a feeling of closeness that precedes it. So for one, sex is an outgrowth of closeness, and for the other, it is a catalyst for it. It's just we come at it from different angles, and we're going to have to figure that one out in our marriage. If we're having difficulty in the area of sex, and we look at our spouse, and we just like, I'm going to play possum or something like that. Maybe what we're really saying is, I don't feel close to them because I've got a grudge. And I got a problem with them, and there's an unresolved conflict in my heart. And that's really the issue there. And so again, the sexual dimension of our relationship is going to bring some of these things out.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.